What time is it? Do we have to start the show now, or can I keep working on my collage of Peter Dutton newspaper cutouts?
It's about 9:10.
These two Peter Duttons look like they're kissing. Oh, Peter, you big flirt. Wait, what was the time again?
It's 9:11.
Oh, God, I almost forgot. Everybody get out of the desks. Stop, drop, and roll. It's 9:11 again. Everybody down. Everybody down.
It's 9:12 now.
Oh, every day.
Canberra. Economic.
What the housewives of Australia need to understand is they do the iron.
Minister for
Team Idiot.
Minister for having a go.
Interesting to see if he
is a Chinese spy.
Fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Every dollar from the taxpayer.
So commit suicide, Tony Abbott, you know?
She'll be right.
Good on you, mate.
Welcome to the Weekly Hour.
Yes, it's time again to draw your loved ones close, but your enemies even closer. Gather around your chosen podcast-enabled device, whether it be a phone, laptop computer, desktop computer, or whatever, and listen very carefully to what we say, chumps.
Yeah, we've got some really important stuff to tell you, and we're only going to say it once, you hear me?
Yeah, we're a gang now, so listen up.
Lindsay has taken her maternity leave to dote on the new royal baby this week, so Luke is here instead.
You going to chill out on your far-right extremist ideas this week, Luke?
Guys, that was a bit. I was doing a bit, you dummies.
Oh, but I spent like hours composing the theme for the Luke Factor.
Yep, gotcha.
This week on The Weekly Hour.
Christopher Pine has unveiled a new plan to make university went tours pay back their hex debts when they move overseas.
What an asshole! Fuck that guy.
Why? That doesn't seem unreasonable to me.
Oh, sorry. That's just my default reaction to Christopher Pine speaking.
The Victorian Labor government have pledged $50 million to start Melbourne public transport running 24 hours over the weekend. The plan is due to go into effect by New Year's Eve 2015. It is yet to be seen whether there are further plans to bring Melbourne up to the bare minimum standards of a modern city, mostly because we haven't read the recently released budget.
A new study has revealed that humans have used toilets since long before smartphones were invented. More on how these early humans kept up with Twitter later in the show.
And Fred Nile, the leader of the Christian Democratic Party, is planning to submit a private members bill, which aims to raise the age at which adults can drink to 21 years, ban women from covering their faces in public, and compel women who are considering abortion to look at pictures of their unborn fetuses.
I am so excited about this next bit of news. I am so excited. I would just like to be the first to say a big The Weekly Hour congratulations to Willie and Kate for the arrival of their new bouncing baby, Her Royal Highness Princess Charlotte Elizabeth Diana Baby of Cambridge.
Lance, are you getting clucky again? I do not want this to be a repeat of what happened last time there was a royal baby.
I just love babies, all right? Is that a crime?
Lance, it's dangerous when you get clucky. It took me weeks to track down the parents of all those babies and return them.
Yeah, and it cost us a fortune in hush money.
They were so cute, though. Besides, if their parents weren't attentive enough to notice a grown man crying and giggling while he ran off with the baby he'd just taken from a pram which was right behind them, who knows if they'd be attentive enough to remember to feed them?
Yeah, whatever. What about this baby?
Well, the royal family is pretty secretive. I mean, they try to stay out of the public eye as often as possible. But the Weekly Hour sources close to Princess Baby Charlotte reveal that she has not yet spoken.
Yes, despite the fact that this baby has been living outside of her mother's womb for almost a week, she has not uttered a single word in her great-grandmother's English.
That's really strange. I mean, a normal baby not speaking immediately after birth isn't out of the ordinary, but this is no normal baby. This is a royal baby. It's pathetic.
For more on this, we're going to cross to the Weekly Hour Royal Babies and Pets correspondent, Artemis H. Smarmworthy.
Well, hello there, chaps and chaplets.
Hello, Artemis. What can you tell us about the royal baby and her not talking? What's up with that?
Well, me old plates, it seems that the little ragamuffin is a little tongue-tied, as it were. There's been a lot of death and strangulation, that's Cockney rhyming slang for speculation, about why it is that the wee royal bubby-wub hasn't been able to open her toothless royal mouth and start chatting away.
So, what have people been saying? What's the reason?
Well, believe it or not, chums, there is a precedent for this kind of thing within the royal family. There's a growing list of princesses through history with strange illnesses like this. One possibility is that baby Charlotte exchanged her voice to an evil sea witch in exchange for a pair of legs to replace her mermaid tail.
Right, well, that's probably not what happened. What else have you got?
The little mite does sleep an awful lot. Maybe her inability to speak is a side effect of pricking her finger on a cursed spinning wheel.
Oh yeah, I think I've heard of this. Kate's dad lied to a king about her being able to spin straw into gold, and then everyone had to guess the name of an imp.
Thomas, I don't think you meant to say imp. That's pretty insensitive to imps. Little people.
Yeah, plus, I'm sure the guy has an actual name that we could have used. We don't have to just identify him by how he's different. What was his name?
I must say, that is rather offensive. Even here in 17th century Stratford-upon-Avon.
I don't know, this all sounds a little far-fetched to me.
Thomas, it's England. Years of childhood books and movies have led me to believe that this kind of crap happens over there on the daily.
He's right, you know. For example, after I opened my ganders this morning and rolled out of my four-poster curtained bed and made my tea and dippy eggs, you know what I saw when I opened the door of my townhouse, which looks exactly like every other townhouse on my street, like in Harry Potter or a Monty Python sketch? My car had transmogrified into a pumpkin. It's like this every day.
Rumpelstiltskin! Rumpelstiltskin! That's it!
And now, a word from our sponsors.
Do you want to correct this before we record?
Nah, mate, script's good. Double checked it.
Look, I can read it as is, but I just don't think it's going to come across.
Just do it! We only booked 10 minutes in the studio!
Rise Nation, Australia Proud Party. Who is Labour? ? Buying halal certified products means that you are directly financially supported the Islamization of Australia, including Sharia law. So this democracy, keep Australia Australian. By Australian, we mean European, Christian, and poorly educated. Just listen to these customer testimonials. ? We're here to cure the cancer of many culturalism. ? I don't know about you, but I like my Asian food American. ? I was sick of Sharia law invading my dietary choices at the supermarket. Even the hummus is halal now. ? I abhor racism. I really do. But this neighbourhood used to be a nice place and now it's full of Asia. Rise Nation Australia Proud Party. Keep kids and also guns. Your families.
There have been concerns voiced in the news lately about the creeping of Sharia law and halal certification into Australian society. There have been claims made by certain vocal elements of the community, particularly on social media, that halal certification, the process whereby foods are deemed acceptable for consumption under Islamic rules, is directing funds towards terrorism. We sent Thomas out into the community, in direct contravention of the community's restraining order against him, to find out more.
Jackie Lambie has said that there are legal loopholes that could allow financing of terrorists and Australia's enemy through halal money. She also stated that one of the core beliefs of her recently announced political party was the opposition to Sharia law, either formal or informal. But what can average Australians do to combat the terrifying threat of Sharia law? It was clear that the mere fact that the only way that Sharia law could be implemented in Australia would be if it were put to a referendum, which would require a majority of votes in not only the House and Senate, but also in the entirety of the Australian populace, and the further fact that only 8 of the 44 referendums that have been held in Australia since Federation have carried, would not be enough to stop Sharia law from definitely infecting our great southern land and also destroying our traditional Aussie values, the fair go, family, battlers, and also fair dinkumness. Last month, leader of the One Nation Party and 90s punchline, Pauline Hanson, told Channel 9's Today program that halal certification was a profit money-making racket. But who was this racket profit money-making for? To find out, I spoke to Dazza O'Sullivan, founder, CEO, secretary, coffee boy, sole member and spokesman for the Rise Nation Australia Proud Party. Dazza, under Australian law, funding terrorism can potentially lead to a life prison sentence.
Well, that hasn't fucking stopped him, has it? These bloody Muslims don't respect the Australian way of life.
Well, I'm convinced. But what would make these halal certification organisations, of which there are around 20 in Australia, willing to take such a massive risk?
Mate, it's obvious to anyone with half a brain that these Muslims just love terrorism. They don't care if they spend life in prison. They think that there are 72 virgins in prison.
Hmm. Now, according to several food companies, such as Nestle and the Byron Bay Cookie Company, halal certification has a negligible effect on the cost of the food product. A Nestle spokesperson even said that the cost isn't passed on to consumers. How does this gel with your party's claims about a halal tax?
Halal tax? That reminds me. The other day I was walking through the Franger Shopping Centre with the missus, one of these fucking towelheads bumps into her and didn't even apologise. They don't respect the Australian way of life, these fucking...
As knowledgeable as Mr. O'Sullivan was about the issue, I needed to get to the hard, sinewy numbers. And who better to ask than someone from Austrade, the federal government's trade body? Who better to ask than someone from Austrade, the federal government's trade body? You, Lily Wensdale.
Sorry? What are you asking?
I'm just setting up the bit, Lily. This is for radio. I'm a journalist, you see.
Okay.
Pauline Hanson claims that the halal certification industry is worth $3 trillion. That seems like a lot of money, Lily.
No, that's not right. On several levels. Exact figures are hard to come by on this, but our estimates put the entirety of the global halal certified food industry at most as high as $2 trillion, probably much closer to $1 trillion. Furthermore, those estimates are for the total value of the food industry, not the value of the certification process. Halal certification would be a minuscule portion of that amount.
You can't give me an exact figure.
Well, it would be very hard to estimate, so...
So the number could be anything, couldn't it, Lily? It could be as high as, say, $3 trillion.
No.
Sure, but whatever the number is, $3 trillion. Surely it can't be good for Australians to be spending money on certifying food so that Muslims can eat them, right? Do Muslims even eat, Lily?
Yes, and furthermore, it may well be a benefit to the Australian economy. For instance, Indonesia represents the largest Muslim population in the world, and all food sold to that country must be halal certified. And we export a great deal of food to Indonesia, Thomas. They are the third biggest importer of Australian foods. Think of it like this. If we were selling cars to the United States, it wouldn't make sense to send them right-hand drive ones. They wouldn't use them.
Lily was trying to double-talk me. I couldn't make sense of anything she said, so I decided to go to the source. I was going to have to visit the Mecca of the Muslim world, the Middle East. I had to go to the Nation of Islam itself and find out what was really going on. But I was caught by my first juicy pork-filled snag before I even departed. As I prepared my flight bookings, I was shocked to learn that the Nation of Islam didn't exist on any map, past or present. Could Jackie Lambie have been wrong? Or had the Muslims simply hidden the nation somewhere beneath the Earth's crust? But I was put off only momentarily and soon booked a flight to the home of Islamic State, Iraq/Syria/the Levant. I'm at the airport now, and I've decided that I'll leave my microphone on the whole time I'm on this story so that I have a complete record of everything that happens while I'm trying to get to the bottom of this.
Sir, I'm going to need you to step out of the line.
Can I ask why?
No, there's nothing to worry about, sir. It's just a random check. We'll scan you, and you can be on your way to... Oh, your ticket says Iraq. Wonderful. You'll have a wonderful time there, I'm sure.
Oh, well, that...
Wait, you're not from north or west of Sydney or Melbourne, are you?
Well, yeah, but... I'm white and my hair isn't red. I'm a journalist.
Sir, could you please eat this slice of deli ham?
Well, of course.
Oh, my mistake, sir. Enjoy your trip.
Thanks. Got any more of that ham? After landing at Iraq International Airport and checking into the Baghdad Hilton, I set to work finding the boss of Halal. My sources had told me that I should get in touch with an organization called ISIS. Hey guys, I'm in Iraq. How should I swing this thing?
You need to find ISIS. You know that.
Yeah, but aren't they super dangerous? Like, I didn't...
It's ISIS, Thomas. Find them. This call is expensive. We're going now.
Thanks for the help, you guys. While leaving the hotel, I saw one of those flyers with the little cut-up phone numbers hanging off of the bottom. It was an ISIS flyer, and luckily for me, there was one little cut-up phone number tab left to rip off. I called the number on the tab. After a long and pleasant conversation with a representative from the organization, they suggested a time and place to meet with them. It would mean a long and tiring hike through the mountains and deserts of Iraq, past bandits and checkpoints. I had only half a packet of Betty Crocker biscuits and a moldy Beefy's pie left, barely enough non-halal food to survive the journey. so I refused. After some negotiating, they agreed to come to the hotel.
Hello, I'm Isis. Pleased to meet you, Thomas.
Thanks for meeting me here. I really don't like to exert myself physically.
I could tell over the phone. This isn't really conventional for us, but we're trying to improve our public image. We thought we'd reach out just this once.
Thank you. That's very considerate of you.
Oh, it's no problem. Now, were you interested in joining our little band of thieves, murderers, slavers, and general evildoers?
Oh, no, no, no. Nothing like that. I'm trying to learn about halal certification. Would you like a drink, by the way?
Oh, no, thank you.
Go on, mate. Have a drink. What do you have? I've got scotch, vodka jelly shots?
No, I don't drink alcohol, actually.
Oh, how about a 72 virgin cocktail, then?
I'm fine, really.
Come on, man. I murdered four of your agents with my bare hands to set up this meeting. And now you're saying you won't even have a drink with me? It's un-Australian, is what it is.
I'm not Australian.
No, you're bloody well not.
So did we go to all this trouble setting this up for you to attack my personal and religious choices? Or did you have some questions for me?
Oh, right. I'm sorry. I just get so worked up when people won't conform to my way of living. Question the first. Some Australians have formed the opinion that the purchase of halal certified foods is directly funding terrorist organisations. As ISIS is currently one of the most prominent terror groups, how many discreet briefcases of unmarked non-sequential bills do you receive from Big Halal each week?
Well, frankly, Thomas, I'm deeply offended by the very notion that we would be taking handouts from faceless corporations like the halal certification companies. ISIS is a completely self-made, independently bankrolled organisation. We do all our own fundraising and it's a lot of work. We had a Kickstarter from which we're still sending out t-shirts to backers. We hold a weekly bake sale at the first Baghdad Cub Scout Hall and spent months setting up those partnerships with the Mexican drug cartels. I mean, do you understand how hard it is to be using drug money when one of the pillars of your religion is sobriety? But these are just the sacrifices us dreamers need to succumb to if we're ever going to make it in this big, scary world. You know what, Thomas? I had high hopes for you. We're big fans of your work here, but I guess it's true what they say. Never meet your heroes. This interview is over.
The ISIS man had left, and with that the trail had gone cold. I was heading home. It had been an exciting 10 hours in Iraq, and I would be nursing a hangover for a week, but I think I'd learned what I needed to learn from this great sunburnt country. Obviously, the super profits generated by those in charge of halal certification weren't going back to the Australian people, so they must have been going here. The Byron Bay Cookie Company said a few weeks ago that the cost of halal certification was 0.003% of their total costs of doing business. With a company that size, that could be billions of dollars. It could be $3 trillion. As I walked back into the weekly hour offices and handed out the souvenirs I'd bought for my colleagues, I noticed the sugar near the coffee machine. It was halal. First this little office in scenic Melbourne, next the world? We'd have to wait and see.
The poker-faced, now former leader of the Australian Greens, Christine Milne, has handed in her shock resignation this week. Milne announced that she was going to be ending her 25 years in politics to spend more time in Tasmania for some reason. This can't be right. Tasmania. Oh, well, her family's there. I guess that kind of makes sense. Kind of.
Unfortunately, the Greens haven't really put on the kind of ugly and public messy leadership infighting, which shows like the Weekly Hour have come to expect and rely on to generate news hours.
Luckily, Milne neglected to mention her retirement to literally all of her colleagues at once, so some of them were mildly surprised to have learned of the news via the media, and now we and other news outlets have something to get all up in a huff about.
Following her announcement, members of politics from all sides are taking part in the customary pretend we haven't said all kind of horrible things about one another for the last forever, which follows the realisation that they'll never have to see each other in a professional capacity ever again.
Tony Abbott, Prime Minister of Australia and aged piece of leather stretched over a misshapen walnut, said of Milne that, "We come from very different political traditions, but I respect Christine Milne as I respect all senior members of the Parliament. It takes a great deal of commitment and patriotism to offer to serve in the Parliament."
Well, that's a sentiment that I'm sure Christine Milne returns, and they're obviously going to miss one another a lot. Which is why we're going to take a look back at the immense respect they have demonstrated for one another over the years.
This is the one day of the year when it's good to be green. It is a monumental blunder for this nation under a climate-denying Prime Minister.
And we know that we can never do that by doing cheap and tawdry deals with the Greens.
All Tony Abbott does is to try and distract the debate.
Luckily, someone has already stepped up to put his feet into the shoes which were previously occupied by the feet of the former leader of the Greens, Christine Milne. His name is Richard Di Natale.
Milne has congratulated Di Natale on his new job, saying he's been absolutely a stalwart in the last few years and built a real profile, especially for his concern around health in particular. I know that Richard brings a lot of experience and will be a wonderful asset to the Greens.
And the praise has continued to roll in for the new leader of the Greens.
Deputy Prime Minister and leader of the now-defunct National Party, Warren Truss, said that he's interested in finding common ground with the new leader of the Greens.
Yes, Truss said that there may be some issues we'll agree on from time to time, and I hope his association with Country Victoria will lead him to want to make decisions that are in the interest of country areas, as well as people who live in the cities.
Now, common ground with Warren Truss, his supporters won't like that.
Are you talking about Truss or Di Natale?
Either.
What's this dude's agenda for the Greens?
It says here that among their many priorities are health, social security and... Oh, here's one that'll shock the punters. Apparently he wants action on climate change.
Well, that's got common ground with Truss fucked.
That's probably for the best.
Tony Abbott was nearly in tepid water this week after The Age published a story which didn't explicitly accuse Tony Abbott of telling the gay ambassador to France to his face that he didn't want to meet his partner because he hates the gays, but which certainly implied that Tony Abbott told the gay ambassador to France to his face that he didn't want to meet his partner because he hates the gays.
That's right, Thomas. The Age outlined a story in an article titled "Ambassador to France Offers Resignation After Bizarre Abbott Airport Incident."
Abbott Airport? Well, aside from the fact that there's an airport in France named after Prime Minister Abbott, I don't see how calling it an Abbott incident implies that it was completely his fault. We don't go tracking down the descendants of John Monash and putting them up against the wall every time someone crashes their car on the Monash freeway.
Prime Minister Abbott later confirmed that Ambassador Peter Stevens' partner was in fact asked to stay in the car, but said he would have been happy to meet with him. He said, "My understanding is that there was some issue at the level of junior officials, and I don't concern myself with these things."
So the question becomes, given Tony Abbott's strong track record of being Tony Abbott, why does The Age feel a need to trump up accusations about Abbott being a homophobe?
Yeah, I mean, there's already plenty of substantiated evidence for that.
Lots of terrific commitments between gay partners, but I just don't think that marriage is the right term to put on it. Briefly. Well, just because that's what a marriage is.
People today tend to think of themselves not so much as members of the community, but as women, blacks, migrants, homosexuals, or whatever.
If it's marriage, it is between a man and a woman.
Homosexuality. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
Oh, I probably feel a bit threatened.
Just as a general principle, I want to see stable, committed relationships, but I do think that a marriage, by definition, is between a man and a woman.
I know some... gay people?
Well, there is no doubt that it challenges, if you like, orthodox notions of the right order of things.
Let it never be said that the Weekly Hour is biased.
I'm glad we could help to clear the Prime Minister's good name. Now it's time for the Sport Report with Mort Dingleport.
Yes, I'm here at the official sports ball stadium where it appears that two groups of men in their 20s and 30s have divided themselves into teams which are coordinated by colour at this time.
Fascinating insight. What else can you tell us about this sport?
Well, it looks very much as though one of the teams is adorned in colours, whereas the other team has wisely chosen to distinguish themselves by wearing different colours. It's all very exciting.
Terribly exciting.
Now, I'm just getting word that the two teams will play a game of some sort against one another. Sometimes a team must win, but other times a team must lose. This is vital.
Mort, why do you suspect are these opposing teams choosing to engage in this sort of behaviour? Will this have wider consequences in the natural world, in your opinion?
There are no consequences for any of this in the natural world, it seems, but it does make one wonder why. What does this mean? Did the players' parents love them when they were children? Are the sports balls symbolic of a greater issue in our society? And what does this say about the upcoming federal budget, if anything?
We can't really say it this time, can we, Mort?
We can't, Thomas. We really can't. What I can tell you, however, is that when one of the teams win the game here, many people will be extremely happy. That said, many other people will be terribly sad. Either eventuality, according to the figures I have here, looks likely to end in the same result. Rioting.
Rioting, you say?
Yes. Anguish-based rioting, as is traditional for the practice. Or celebratory rioting. Nothing marks an occasion of joy and victory like a few smashed shop windows, you know.
Yes, I do know that. I know it like tons.
Tell us, Mort, what else can we expect? Overpriced beer? Hearing damage for the patrons, perhaps?
It is all up in the air at the moment, Thomas. But I will stay here for the remainder of the week to keep an eye on things as they develop.
Thanks for that report, Mort.
I've been Mort Dingleport with the Sport Report with Mort Dingleport for the Weekly Hour.
The Herald Sun have emphatically missed the point again this week, framing last Friday's protest by around 12,000 Melburnians against the forced closure of Aboriginal communities in Western Australia as an inconvenience to commuters, completely ignoring the aims of the actual protest.
Titled Still Selfish, Still a Rabble, the piece was a sequel to their earlier work, Selfish Rabble Shut City. The article included harrowing tales of those affected by the protests, such as Friday night football fans, who were among those caught up in the gridlock, and 71-year-old Faye, who said, "Looks like I've got to walk."
Breaks your heart.
Indeed. The Herald Sun didn't mention the rabble that stopped cars and public transport early on Anzac Day, however, which is the only inconsistency we could find in the article.
Robert Doyle, Lord Mayor of Melbourne and titanic vacuous cunt of such monumental volume that light actually bends around his cavernous entrance for a distilled, unknowable fear that it will be forever vanquished, described protesters as self-indulgent and said that shutting down the city for 2 hours was not the way to win sympathy or support for a cause.
But the protesters hit back via placard, as is traditional for protesters, saying, "Sorry for the inconvenience, we are trying to change the world."
Andrew Bolt, Herald Sun columnist and man who looks like his teeth are made from polished squares of low-quality cheese, also weighed in on the issue, saying the protest was divisive and racist.
Wait, he's saying the protest was racist?
Racist against white people, he means.
Oh, right, because Andrew Bolt.
Well, that's it again for this week.
Your homework for this week is to tell one friend about the Weekly Hour and force them to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, press our words on WordPress, and figure out if we come up on the first page of Google yet.
And that'd better be an improvement on your previous work. I gave that a D. Thanks for nothing, you jerks.
The Weekly Hour was produced in Melbourne, Australia. This episode was written by Lance Turnbull, Luke Webb, and Thomas Gibbons. Thomas, Lance, and Luke were voiced by Lance, Luke, and Thomas. Lily Wensdale was voiced by Freya Clothgood. Rise Nation Australia Proud Party spokesperson was voiced by Captain Typo. Our logo was designed by Alison Johnson and Lance Turnbull. Music by Lance Turnbull. The Weekly Hour was produced by Luke Webb and edited by Lance Turnbull.
Trust said that... Oh, fuck. What's happening now?
Rioting, you say?
Just say yes.
Yes. The article included harrowing tales of those affected by the protest. I've lost control of my mouth.
You're turning into one of them.
Let's go on.
This is selfish rabble.
That's right, Thomas. The aged outline... The aged...
Old people.
Because it's old. Because it's an old newspaper.
I mean it. It's on purpose. Leader of the now defunct National Party. The National Party.
In the government department, for instance, you have extensive courses on things like feminism and the political exploitation of women and what have you. And quite frankly, I think that these courses are attempts... not only are they trivial, but they are attempts by unscrupulous academics to impose simplistic ideological solutions upon students.